19 proposed cabinet members of the president were approved by the Majlis, our parliament.
Well, thank you, Marzia. Now, if I'm not mistaken, this is but the second time that this has happened in some 46 years. So it's very significant. I mean, for all the ministers to receive the vote of confidence, and you have to, I mean, pay attention to the fact that we have our president, President Pezeshkian, he is from the Reformist Party, and the representatives, the parliament is predominantly actually principalist, and they have approved all of these candidates. Now, 15 out of the 19 candidates for the ministries actually received more than 200 votes. That is, you see, the minimum for becoming a minister is 145 votes. But they have received 200 votes, like 15 have received 200 and over votes. So this is actually very significant this way.
Okay, well, Said Muaz, you know, Iran has seen a lot of ups and downs, especially looking at the last 3 months. If we see, like, on May the 19th, of course, when the nation was shocked into finding out that President Raisi was martyred in a helicopter crash. And, of course, besides the funerals for those who had been killed, the country had 50 days to hold elections and then had to hold two elections. And, of course, then the inauguration of Dr. Pezeshkian. I mean, your overall assessment of how the country has handled the sudden transition overall until the cabinet was approved.
You know, thank you for having me. I think this is a really reflective moment of Iran's solidarity and spirit of resistance, spirit of unity in times of difficulty. And that's the spirit of the Iranian revolution that we're seeing unfold before us. The Iranian people coming together in difficult time, as you mentioned, the loss of their leader a few months back, and of course the recent attacks in Tehran and what's going on in Gaza, all that interconnected, and facing this challenge of the United States and European Union's support for Israel. You know, and of course, we know some of the EU countries have been breaking ranks and things are slowly eroding, but this shows the resilience of the Iranian people. Coming together in a tough time. And you know, it's not about those petty politics that we're seeing, for example, in Israel unfolding right now. We see a country on the other side here coming together, people from all parts of the spectrum, as my colleague mentioned, there's a reformist party, and getting this type of consensus of more than 200 parliamentarians is something unheard of. Hasn't happened since 2001. I think that was the last time something has happened like that, all the ministers have been approved. And this clearly shows the direction where this country, it is ready to take on challenges. And there will be some coming through the door, as we know what's going on with Gaza and what's going on in southern Lebanon, and also within Iran itself, particularly coming from the West. And perhaps we'll talk a little bit more about that later.
Yes, exactly. We definitely will. Well, let's get into some of the challenges, Maryam, when we talk about the various challenges that this government may have. Let's start from inside the country, because let's talk about what President Pezeshkian has reiterated, what is important to him and the main goals of this government.
Well, as you know, I mean, the challenges stated by presidential candidates in general when they were running for presidency, by Dr. Pezeshkian, by Iran's leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khamenei, is how important economy is. Because, I mean, Iran is a very strong country in many ways. You know, its role in the axis of resistance, you know that, I mean, despite all the threats that has been on Iran ever since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iran has grown to be a major power, not only in the region, but in the world. However, there are certain issues. Now, as you know, there are so many different things that are going on in terms of basically teachings, in terms of family, in terms of housing, all of these issues that is happening to the basically ordinary people. And a lot of governments are not very much focused on that. And they put it on, I mean, they allow for so much of a free market that there are rarely any government programs a lot of times, or they're very insufficient that in terms of helping people with housing. Now, in Iran, for instance, it used to be that there was a very good focus on basically Iranians being homeowners, right? And now, as there are more economic difficulties, there has been a shift away from that, and we are having fewer people being homeowners. So these are actually some of the major challenges inside the country, is that the economy. Now, it has to do with the job market. It has to do with housing. It has to do with a lot of different issues that we're facing, partially because of the sanctions. Of course, two-thirds of the world is sanctioned by the U.S. However, I don't think any country has been sanctioned to the same extent that Iran has been sanctioned. And Iran has been dealing with this for 46 years. But as the president said, actually, he said that, you know what, I mean, with all these, of course, sanctions are a huge burden. But the president himself said that we cannot blame the U.S. for everything, because really, Iran is a rich country. Iran has a very rich culture. Iran has a very rich history. Iran could have done much better even with the sanctions. And as the president said in one of his speeches, that we very much have ourselves to blame, and that basically what he believes, and what a lot of Iranians believe actually, is that we cannot have a system where we have, I mean, not like the U.S., where like there's always, you know, there are the main two parties that every party is trying to basically downgrade the other party, and they're not cooperating. And of course, they have the deep state, and that's a whole other story. But what the president has been talking about is that we can actually solve the issues inside the country, regardless of what the U.S. might do, if we only have unity, if we have a national consensus. And he's very right in that. I think a lot of Iranians heard that, and they felt that, and they said that this is what we have to do. And I think that, I mean, this powerful speech was also part of the reason that, because as I told you, we already had that, we had the predominantly principalist parliament voting in every single minister suggested by a reformist president. Of course, he's everyone's president now, but let's remember he is from the reformist party. So they have put these differences aside. They're okay. Saying, let's work together.
Yeah, very significant. What about Mary Mazzocchi has said? I mean, when we look at, because we've always heard, especially if you look at very entities outside of the country and talking about the divide. But what the president has continued to stress since he's taken office, and even prior to that, was the importance of unity, working together. And what we saw today seems to indicate that the parliament, the Majlis, is also on board with that. The question for you, Syed Muaz, how significant and important is that right now when we look at the situation that is taking place in the region and globally? You mentioned earlier about, of course, Palestine and the genocide, and, of course, the pressures from the various supporters of the Zionist entity. I mean, your take on that side of things.
Well, I think that's a very important point, because in his speech he made it very clear where the foreign policy was going to be focused. And he basically went down and said, basically, Far East Asia, China, Africa, Latin America, pretty much the whole world aside from Europe and the United States and Northern America. And I think that was a very kind of interesting kind of pivot that was very important, because he was bold about, this is where our priority regions. These are the regions where we will be kind of building relationships with. Again, goes into that global shift that's been going on for quite a bit, that where we have this China, Russia challenges this U.S. hegemonic 50 years of, what you can say, even post-Cold War scenario, rather, where it's just been one-sided. And I think that dynamic is definitely going to be in that direction. So foreign policy-wise, I don't see any major changes. I must give a caveat for this, because one of the selections of the ministers that was somewhat criticized was Abbas Araghchi, and he was one of the negotiators for the Iranian deal. And there were some questions around that. But I still feel that, you know, if you remember, Donald Trump was the one in 2020 that unilaterally pulled out of that. So I think this also sends a message internationally, because we know the U.S. is kind of even at times abandoning Israel. And we know a lot of European states have broken ranks. And so this is actually kind of an interesting play here, that Iran is basically saying, look, those who want to talk on principle, we're opening the doors for you on that. You know, one of the major things I must also make a mention here of another minister that is very important is Farzana Sadiq. And the reason why is, you know, recently there was a lot of criticism about Iran and the treatment of women. It's in this mantra of the West, and we already know that's the kind of propaganda that they put out to try to build some anti-Iranian sentiment in their circles. That was actually quite important as well, because it's showing again that these rumors and this idea that women are secondary citizens in the Islamic Republic of Iran is far from the truth. So I think that was also a very important move. I think Iran is positioning itself very strategically on the international fronts when it comes to diplomatic means. And I think some of the people that are brought forth create that atmosphere where those who want to break rank from this ridiculous behavior that Israel has turned to, bombing schools, hospitals, just horrendous things. There's nothing they can stand for. So if Iran is showing a window of opportunity to engage, I think this is going to bind the United States and Israel. And I think this is the real win. And we have to wait to see how this will play out. But I think this is as important as the military front, of course, and that, of course, the revolutionary support, that he reiterated these elements of the resistance. But I think also, you know, there's some things that can be won from the pen. And I think we're going to start to see some of that in this new cabinet that he's put together.
Okay. Well, Maryam, Sayed Muaz talked about the mantra coming out of the West. And I mean, looking at the run-up to this election, and that if we look at foreign media and how they talked about it, that either it doesn't make a difference who will be elected, because actually more of a selection, it's the leader who decides everything. I mean, your thoughts, and even up until today, of how that coverage has been.
Now, Marzia, you know better than I do. I mean, there's, of course, we have to cover it for the audiences. And I think the audience already knows. I mean, first of all, look at who is talking about this. I mean, I was just reading BBC articles accusing Iran of, you know, just focusing on it's all about the ideology. It's not about basically expertise. And I'm like, you guys have a king, for goodness sake. It's the 21st century. I mean, he gets to pick the prime minister. A lot of your taxes go to paying him, the royal family, the House of Lords. So it's all, I mean, you know, so one aspect of it is to, first of all, take a look at who's doing this. I mean, only 3 days ago, it was the anniversary of the coup d'etat in Iran. Now, this is prior to the Islamic Revolution. Now, when Iran had a prime minister that was trying to nationalize Iran's oil, what did the Brits and the U.S. did? What they did was they started a coup and they overthrew Iran's democratically elected prime minister. So it's really not about democracy. I mean, if they had access now to Iran's oil, if they had managed to basically keep plundering Iran's oil, you would not be hearing anything about them from them regarding Iran's democracy. I mean, now you see how they're treating Libya, right? So after Gaddafi, and of course it was all about democracy. It was all about treating women, how they treat women, and so. So first of all, let's take a look at who's saying that. It's very important. And I feel like generally, it's not only about what is said, but who is saying that. That's very important for our audiences, I think. And I think they have very much understood, especially with the genocide, with the ongoing genocide. They see the people, the entities, they see the regimes always, that are always talking about democracy are now supporting a genocide that people are seeing, like, basically every day on a daily basis. And they're like, why isn't anybody doing anything about this? Why isn't the international institutions doing anything about this? Because they were not made to do anything about
right.
this. Because so,
right.
I mean, we have this on one hand. And when you come back, I actually want to get a little more into detail with actually how Iran's systems work.
Right. Well, Sayed Muaz, you heard what Maryam said about watching who says what and who's doing what. When we look at the time of what is happening right now in the world, and as she said, especially during this ongoing genocide, more and more people are becoming aware of the reality. On the other side of the coin, do you think more and more people are becoming aware of Iran, Iran's world, Iran's role as far as being the leader of the resistance front and the importance of it? I mean, do you see this assessment being changed globally as more reality is setting in for people or not?
Oh, absolutely. And I think this is not just true for the Islamic world. This is true for even beyond the Islamic world and non-Muslim jurisdictions who clearly see Iran as a true champion of peace and human rights and the Palestinian people. And I'm not saying that just to be saying that. The reality is what Israel has done is not only childish behavior, it's completely behavior that violates every norm, international law, basic ethics, and Iran is the only state, officially speaking, aside from, of course, groups, and I should say even in Yemen to some extent, who have been standing with the Palestinian people and doing something about it. And this is, I think, very important because it symbolizes that this is the actors. These countries are the actors actually doing something for the Palestinians. And there is no doubt in my mind that if we pick up anybody, 9 out of 10 people across the world are supporting the Palestinian people, are sympathetic to the Palestinian people, and they see Iran in this positive light. And all those little critiques that I mentioned about earlier, like, for example, what my colleague also mentioned here, is the how the anti-women perspective, they're addressing these things through possibly the minister. You have people who are saying, oh, they don't want to negotiate. Then they're bringing in these reformists that have, in a sense, they're more welcoming, you can say, because people say, oh, the others were a little bit more hardline. This is creating a more diplomatic environment that I think this cannot be a better moment right now for Iran to make this move and have these people in these positions. Because even those people who are on the sidelines with Iran and they had sympathy with the Palestinians now are like, listen, these guys, this current cabinet is someone that we can really approach. And I feel that Iran is, like I said earlier, you know, it's one thing to get things done militarily. It's another to get things done diplomatically. And I right. think we're going to see a lot more of that happening with this new cabinet, a diplomatic front to end what's going on in Israel. And beyond that, the injustices that, of course, the hegemonic front, as you always say, carries on. And I think Iran has identified before the world's eyes, before the people of the world, that they are the nation that stands up against this aggression.
Okay. Well, Maryam, I mean, your thoughts when we look at the situation we're talking about in the world and also looking at what the hegemonic front has been saying about Iran, even with this election and now that Mr. Pezeshkian has mm-hmm. taken over, trying to say that there is a difference, Iran is going to be somewhat different in how they deal, for example, with the Palestinian situation mm-hmm. or in general. I mean, your assessment of that.
Well, this is a very old technique that they've always been doing that. They have always labeled certain people with a different culture as the other, right? So we have the reformists, we have the principalists, and they generally call the principalists hardliners or ultra-conservatives or, you know, just crazies, basically. So this is how they have always portrayed. I mean, and we have these different parties. Of course, here's something to have in mind. Iran has a very different culture. Iran is a Muslim-majority country. Iran is a Shia-majority country. You know, even in Iran, even, I mean, people come and they're amazed by, I mean, the variety of people and their opinions, but
30 seconds, okay. Mary, I'm sorry.
So in all their different walks of life, Iranians are anti-imperialism, right? So, but what the imperialists have been trying to do, they've been trying to say that, oh, in the beginning, they say, oh, the reformist candidate is not going to win presidency. Then he does. Because, I mean, and as you know, most of our governments have been reformist governments. Then they say they're not going to let him pick his ministers. Then he does. Then they say the principalists are not going to vote in the ministers. And then he does. And then they're like, well, they were all picked by the leader anyways. Well, you know what? Our leader is running the axis of resistance, and the American president cannot run up 2 stairs. So obviously people have respect for our leader, as, you know, as others don't have for theirs, so...
Okay, well said, Moaz. I mean, looking at, of course, this very sensitive time, and of course, Iran has said that it's going to respond to the Ismail Haniyeh assassination that took place inside of this country. I mean, do you see that as a challenge? Do you think that this government would handle it different? Or do you see this as a continuation, the same line, even if President Raisi was in power, or now that Mr. Pezeshkian is in power, that line of actually resistance and standing up against hegemonic powers is still the criteria?
There be no doubt. That is the same stance and principle that will remain because the Islamic Republic of Iran is here to stay. And I think that's the point that people need to realize. And what my colleague was mentioning is exactly those things, is they don't realize that in principle, Iran, the Islamic Revolution of Iran, is here to stay. Now, if you want to come to the table and negotiate and talk and give principled ethics in that discussion, more than welcome. And you know what? There might be a different strategy. As I said, maybe not so much as a military one, as a diplomatic one, but not to say that they're going to not exercise the military options. Of course they will, but they will also use diplomatic weapons in a way that I think that's different. So this is one thing that's different, but in principle, they're not going to change that stance. And let that be very clear for people who think otherwise.
All right. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. Mary Mazacheb, Iran Desk. Zed Moaz Shah, Executive Director, Center for Islamic Law and Human Rights, out of Karachi. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Madarsi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll discuss some of the contents of chapter Naml, the 27th chapter of the Holy Quran, as well as some of the commentary points of the verses. Brothers and sisters, as you were with us, we are discussing the 62nd verse of this chapter. Now let's listen to this verse.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
أَمَّنْ يُجِيبُ الْمُضْطَرَّ إِذَا دَعَاهُ وَيَكْشِفُ السُّوءَ وَيَجْعَلُكُمْ خُلَفَاءَ الْأَرْضِ أَإِلَهٌ مَّعَ اللَّهِ قَلِيلًا مَّا تَذَكَّرُونَ.
Is he not best who responds to the desperate one when he calls upon him and removes evil and makes you inheritors of the earth? Is there a deity with Allah? Little do you remember.
So, dear listeners, أَمَّنْ يُجِيبُ الْمُضْطَرَّ إِذَا دَعَاهُ وَيَكْشِفُ السُّوءَ. Regarding this verse, we mentioned that there are two important things. أَمَّنْ يُجِيبُ, there is this state of إِجَابَة, an answering. الْمُضْطَرَّ إِذَا دَعَاهُ, the kind of needy person, distressed person, when he's calling. So these two important factors, we were discussing the kind of relation that existed between the two. What is the relationship? What is the relation, actually, between the state of iltirar and calling on to the Almighty Allah and answer from the Almighty Allah? So We said that the capability of the people in receiving the mercy of the Almighty Allah, an answer from the Almighty Allah, is different. So it depends on the people. And by capability, we thoroughly discussed and we said that it means the ontological need towards the Almighty Allah. Now, we said that many verses of the Holy Quran, as well as the verses in this chapter, like the 61st one and the 60th one, were raising our awareness about our neediness, about how powerful the Almighty Allah is. And the awareness of man about his neediness towards Allah has different signs which become manifest in his prayer to him, in his supplication to him, in his dua to him. The higher the degree of one's awareness of his need to Allah, the more distinct shall be these signs in his prayer. Among the most important and significant of these signs are humility and khushu' and also khudu' and submission. So these states, like weeping in the supplication, pleading, turning towards the Almighty Allah, and taking resort with Almighty Allah during prayer, show how a person actually is deep in the state of iltirar and in need of the Almighty Allah. In matter of fact, these signs actually reveal the intensified sense of this kind of ontological need that man has in his body, in his soul. So these things are effective in the acceptance of prayer. So when we are discussing the concept of prayer on one hand and ijabah and response on the other, we cannot discuss irrespective of these important things. So there has appeared in the Holy Quran some injunctions or exhortations to acquire these spiritual states. For example, the Holy Quran says, so you invoke him tadarru'an and also secretly. So you invoke him suppliantly and secretly. Tadarru'an wa khufya. This is one state. Or, for example, khawfan wa tama'an, the Holy Quran says, you supplicate him with fear and hope. These tadarru, this khawf, this kind of fear, I mean, this is not the best translation of the kind of fear that we have of the Almighty Allah when it comes to terms of supplication and talking to him, but this is the best we can translate. But this is confirming man's awareness of his needs when he's engaged in supplication.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
So, dear listeners, as you were with us, we said that the relation between يُجِيبُ الْمُضْطَرْ إِذَا دَعَى, between إِجَابَه and the dua, between response and prayer, is so important to be discussed, and we have been discussing it for a couple of episodes up to now. Now, we said that one of the most important factors in this case, in this relation, is the kind of need. And the most important in this sense is the kind of need which is realized, which is understood, and which is intensified by the different states. And these intensifications of our actually states of iltirar have their own signs. We said that we are recommended in our different transmitted prayers and supplications, that we have to weep and cry, and we have to be in the state of iltirar. We have to have hope and fear at the very same time. We have to call the Almighty Allah in obvious places and also in secrets. So these are all the signs. So this shows eagerness. This shows humility. And they confirm our awareness of our needs to the Almighty Allah. Why is it important? Because we mentioned in the very first place. That the nature, the essence of supplication and dua is that we have realized we are in a state of neediness and we need someone else to help us. So this is how we approach the Almighty Allah. In this case, we are much closer to the station of ijabah and response. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, has said, "Whenever I remember the martyrdom of the children of Fatima, peace be upon her, my eyes filled with tears."
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
There is no Islam without jihad, the protesters chanted in the As-Sabin Square of the capital Sana'a, where demonstrators rallied in support of Palestine and armed resistance against Israel. Protesters also filled the streets across the northern province of Sa'da and other Yemeni provinces in solidarity with the Yemeni army's latest military operations against Israeli-linked ships in regional waters. Observers say the blockade imposed by Yemen on all Israeli-linked ships have inflicted a severe economic blow, costing the regime billions in lost revenue.
We came out today to renew our solidarity with our brothers in Gaza. We want to send a message to the people and the children and women of Gaza that we will always support them until the victory by the will of Allah. We also came out to support the actions of our armed and naval forces and to congratulate them for their successful military operations.
The protest comes just a day after the leader of Ansarullah movement, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, condemned certain Arab governments for their silence over the Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip. Ansarullah officials at the rally reiterated these sentiments, cautioning that those who profess to follow Islam yet align with its adversaries may face serious consequences from the people.
For those who commit treason by establishing ties with Israel and extending their hands in peace to the occupying entity, we tell them that this enemy will never respect them. You are all worthless to it. To those who normalize ties and extend their hands in peace to the occupation, we tell them that the only thing the free and honorable people will extend to this occupying entity is the sword and the rifle, which will end their regime.
We call on our Yemeni army to strike them with an iron fist. We are with you. Allah is with you. And may the eyes of the cowards never sleep.
In response to Yemen's operations against Israeli interests, the U.S. has deployed warships and aircraft carriers to the region near Yemen. It seems that the deployment aims to counter a potential large-scale attack from Axis of Resistance across the region. According to the Ansarullah leader, the delay in retaliation for Israel's assassination of Ismail Haniyeh is to ensure that the response will take place in a way that changes the balance of power in the entire region. Although the time and place of the retaliatory response remains unknown, what is certain is that a day of reckoning for Israel will come unexpectedly. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
Europe has recorded a new significant spike in gas prices over the past 2 weeks. European natural gas benchmark Dutch TTF's price soared 30% to a nine-month high of 41 euro per megawatt hour on Tuesday. The Dutch TTF is a virtual trading hub in the Netherlands, serving as a key price benchmark for the European gas market used by international traders. However, this increase is much smaller compared to August 2022, when EU gas prices skyrocketed by 1,000% compared to previous decades, following the start of the war in Ukraine and the EU's subsequent decision to sever long-standing energy ties with Russia. Some analysts believe the spike is due to the ongoing conflicts in Ukraine and West Asia.
The new energy speculative bubble in Europe is due to the Ukraine's invasion of the Russian province of Kursk, from where Russian energy giant Gazprom pumps gas to Europe, and Israel's war on Gaza. This has prompted traders to act in anticipation of a cut in flows, which frankly I don't think will occur yet at this stage.
Geopolitical crises in Eastern Europe and West Asia have raised the question about to what extent speculation could drive gas prices. Large energy corporations that have historically dominated the sector worldwide have largely profited from such crises.
L'ottica qual è stata?
The objective since the beginning of NATO's expansion towards Russia was to replace Russian gas supplies to Europe with US's LNG supplies. In Italy, we are now paying U.S. gas supplies 10 times more. It's been a shameful speculation.
Last month, Italy's energy authority, ARERA, said in a report that the country had the highest gas prices in Europe in 2023, with an average virtual trade point price of around 43 euros per megawatt hour.
From a businessman perspective, this new spike in the cost of energy is very much concerning as it impacts our operational costs, which are becoming unsustainable. Families as well are very much affected, as you can imagine, with salaries not keeping up with the cost of living.
Energy Authority ARERA also added that the gas prices in Italy have remained well above the average seen before the price shocks that followed the start of the conflict in Ukraine in February 2022. Max Civili, Rome.
Large-scale joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises this week featured dozens of live-fire drills, many near the demilitarized zone, the heavily fortified border with the DPRK. The war games come amid tit-for-tat activities across the border. South Korea's unification minister labels Pyongyang's response to anti-DPRK propaganda from the south as provocative.
North Korea says it's sending the garbage balloons because of anti-North Korea leaflets, but I think that's just North Korea's claim. It's sending the garbage messages to disrupt our society and create public anxiety. That's why our government has taken firm measures, such as resuming the use of loudspeakers.
The propaganda broadcasts into the DPRK are part of South Korea's peace through strength strategy involving demonstrations of South Korean and U.S. weaponry, including nuclear-capable strategic assets. South Korea's policy toward the DPRK has been shifting between peacemaking and hostility in recent years, depending on the administration in office in Seoul. Now, South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol's hard line has generated heightened military tensions and concerns of a potential violent clash, particularly along the DMZ. Civil society leaders and many South Koreans oppose the joint U.S. drills and view President Yoon's offer of dialogue as right-wing lip service.
They are continuously raising the issue of human rights in North Korea and conducting military exercises to create this atmosphere of fear, announcing contradictory policies. But what's really important is to show that we're sincerely interested in dialogue.
South Korea's Ministry of Interior and Safety Thursday held a civil defense drill for the first time simulating what they call a North Korean nuclear or WMD attack. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Thousands of pro-Palestinians marched outside the Democratic National Convention, which is doing its best to censor the issue of Israel's attempted genocide in Gaza. No pro-Palestinian activist has been granted a main stage speaking slot to address the party, and the word ceasefire has barely been heard. This is even as Democratic operatives are trying to convince America that their presumptive nominee, Kamala Harris, is not the same as outgoing President Joe Biden.
She's still considered the same until she does different. You know, people are infantilizing her, saying because she said ceasefire, but she refuses to do an arms embargo, and she still is a friend of AIPAC. So we are not believing anything until we see some concrete decisions made on an arms embargo.
Many were expecting violent civil disobedience this week, but Biden's quitting the race did appease some of the intense anti-democratic party sentiment. However, organizers say that such fear-mongering was always a manipulation designed to discredit protesters beforehand.
Folks like the ADL and JUF held these press conferences in which they said, we're going to commit violence against Jews and we're going to do all of these things, because they have been put in the position of defending genocide, and you can't do it. And so when you have an indefensible position, you attack your opposition. And so there's going to be riots, there's going to be killing, there's going to be whatever ridiculous things that they said. The reality is that we are a very disciplined movement that believes in a variety of tactics, and we knew that we would be able to handle masses of people this week.
Last week, the Biden-Harris administration approved another huge arms package for Israel, this one amounting to $20 billion. Many said it showed that the Democratic Party has completely ignored the global support for Palestine.
Ever since Joe Biden was forced out by America's elite donor class, Democrats appear to be hoping that voters will simply forget Kamala Harris's co-culpability in arming and supporting Israel. Protesters here say they underestimate just how important Gaza is to so many different types of voters.
The Monday protest was historic. It really was, because we had 20,000 people in the streets. We had them from the black community, Latino, Asian, Native American, white, all nationalities, all religions, people who have no religion, everybody united, even though they all were addressing their own communities and their own community issues, immigrant rights, police accountability, black liberation.
Organizers say they never expected to change Democratic Party policy with 4 days of protests, but they'll keep fighting for human rights in Palestine. A major demonstration against the Democratic Party is planned for the final day of their convention. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
For decades, mosques in Gaza have been considered the most reverted sites, not only because they are religious places, but also due to their cultural values. Many of these mosques were built in ancient times and had historic values, which indicate how deeply rooted they are in this land. Therefore, Palestinians in Gaza have been spiritually and culturally attached to them. Successive generations of Palestinians have recited the Holy Quran, observed their religious rituals, and taken part in other cultural activities at those mosques.
Amid this war, the Israeli occupation has never left any place undestroyed, including the mosques. According to international law, it's prohibited to target holy places. However, the Israeli forces hit and destroy our mosques. For example, the mosques in Al Buraij refugee camp have been completely destroyed. It's a clear message by Israel for the Palestinian people there that there will be no life in Gaza. But our message is that we will remain in our land and we will never abandon it.
Not surprisingly, Israeli strikes on those mosques, particularly the historic ones like Al-Omari in Gaza, have been systematic and deliberate, aiming to eliminate religious and cultural sites in Gaza. The attacks on mosques are in line with Israel's attempt to obliterate the Gaza Strip and reduce it to an unlivable place.
From the start of this war, it's been clear that it is also a religious war that targets holy places. The high number of targeted mosques proves that Israel hits them deliberately. Because these mosques are the main source of resilience for the Palestinian people, there is a strong rapport with these mosques. We will rebuild our mosques and they will remain our source of power.
According to latest estimates, the Israeli military has targeted and destroyed 1,500 mosques in Gaza. This number is growing as Israel's genocidal campaign continues unabated.
Undoubtedly, attacks on mosques in Gaza represent another Israeli violation, in addition to the regime's track record of crimes against the Palestinian people in Gaza. Abu Musabbih, the central area of Gaza Strip.
Israel uses every resource and knowledge available to it, including modern technology, for military purposes and advancing its settlement policy. The regime is exploiting technological advancements to support army operations in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The regime's military spending hit $23 billion in 2022. That jumped to $38 billion in 2024, with a significant portion of the budget allocated to the technology sector. The technology is being used on the ground in Gaza and West Bank.
In the past 6 months, we have observed that strikes are being directed at the occupation forces whenever they enter the camps and villages, and we have been monitoring this on the ground. These losses have led to hesitation among the occupation forces in direct engagement, and their increasing reliance on warplanes, helicopters, and drones. These drones for them reduce casualties on their side while inflicting the greatest possible losses on our people. Yet despite this, the battle continues and our youth is still resisting, inflicting losses on the enemy's army, which could have significant consequences in the long run.
Drones have played a key role in these operations, with the regime carrying out 62 AI-guided targeted strikes against Palestinians. Israel's AI technology has transformed its warfare tactics, especially using drones like Golden Eagle UAV. These lightweight, cost-effective drones use AI to lock onto targets and track them in real time, ensuring precise strikes regardless of lighting conditions. Israel's use of AI-powered weapons raises ethical concerns, as this technology facilitates violence and deepens Palestinians' dispossession by reducing the human cost of the warfare for the Israeli side. Beyond Palestinians, the regime's spyware is used by repressive regimes to monitor dissidents. Israel also develops lethal autonomous weapons system and has exported deadly UAVs to other countries.
From direct assassinations to killing by rockets and military planes to AI-guided attacks on drones, Israel is coming up with ever newer methods to kill Palestinians. Naqa Hamid, Ramallah.
Just days after taking office and in a symbolic move, members of the newly formed government in Yemen have reaffirmed their commitment to the Palestinian cause.
At the beginning of the first week of the work of the government of change and construction, we saw that it was important to visit the office of the Islamic resistance movement Hamas in Sana'a, which is a visit for all the brothers in the Palestinian factions to confirm Yemen's position, starting from the top of the leadership, the leader of the revolution, the Supreme Political Council and the government, that we are with the Yemeni people's strong position, which is considered the strongest in the region. We are all with the Palestinian people.
The visit underscores the solidarity of the government of construction and change with the Palestinian people as it vows to maintain the country's support for Hamas and the broader resistance against Israel. This diplomatic gesture is seen as a clear message to the international community on Sana'a's position on the Israeli genocide in Gaza.
The visit of the government of construction and change, represented by the prime minister, his deputies and ministers, to the office of the Islamic resistance movement Hamas in the beginning of their work, undoubtedly sends a message to us that we are not alone and that the Yemeni government is continuing to support Palestine with all its strength. This support was manifested in the million-man marches across Yemen and also with the participation of the Yemeni armed forces in the Battle of the Flood of Al-Aqsa. This support will not be forgotten by the people of Palestine.
This visit took place at a time when Gaza is subject to a brutal onslaught by the Israeli regime. The genocide, which is backed by both the U.S. and its Western allies, has led to significant civilian casualties and widespread destruction in Gaza. Yet, the international community remains largely silent.
In the face of a global inaction regarding the suffering in Gaza, Yemen's new government is making it clear that its stance on the Palestinian cause remains unchanged and that it will continue to support Palestine by all available means. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Limelight.
The U.S. Democratic Party has unveiled its party platform ahead of the 2024 presidential race, laying out 92 pages of policy priorities with no mention of halting weapons sales to Israel amid the Israeli regime's genocidal war in Gaza. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National Public Radio, NPR, has covered this story and tells us more. U.S. Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris has reiterated Washington's support for Israel, claiming that Tel Aviv has the right to defend itself. Kamala Harris told a rapturous crowd on the fourth and final day of the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, she said, "Let me be clear, I will always stand up for Israel's right to defend itself, and I will always ensure Israel has the ability to defend itself." The event was also attended by pro-Israel and pro-Palestinian Democrats in Chicago, late on Thursday, 22nd of August, as she outlined her stance on the Gaza war and the humanitarian crisis in the blockaded enclave. Stopping short of criticizing the Israeli regime for its months-long onslaught on Palestinians, Kamala Harris said, "What has happened in Gaza in the past 10 months is devastating. So many innocent lives lost. The scale of suffering is heartbreaking." There were scattered shouts of Free Palestine at the convention, during which Kamala Harris officially accepted the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party for November's race. Since the war erupted in October of last year, the Biden administration has stood steadfastly with Israel and has sent military aid to the Israeli regime despite continued pro-Palestine marches across the country. The Democratic National Convention was witness to protests over the Israeli genocide war in Gaza and the Biden administration's Gaza policy, with protesters burning American flags and getting into confrontations with police in Chicago. Speaking to the American news website Axios, pro-Israel Democrats at the convention rejected the notion that there is any difference between Kamala Harris and Joe Biden on the Gaza war. Representative Brad Schneider, Democrat of Illinois, said, "I think the Vice President Harris will be a strong supporter of Israel and carry forward the policies that the Biden administration has carried forth." Representative Steve Cohen, Democrat of Tennessee, also said Harris will continue the historically strong relationship between America and Israel. On Wednesday, 21st of August, and following the Democratic National Convention's refusal to allow a Palestinian person to speak at the convention, Muslim Women for Harris said they can no longer endorse the Democratic nominee. The group issued a statement saying, "We cannot in good conscience continue Muslim Women for Harris in light of this new information that Vice President Harris's team declined their request to have a Palestinian-American speaker take the stage at the Democratic National Convention." Harris has previously met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and underscored her unwavering commitment to Israel. A day earlier, the U.S. police arrested dozens of pro-Palestinian protesters outside the Israeli regime's consulate in Chicago, Illinois, as they demanded an end to the occupying regime's months-long onslaught on Gaza. Police loaded a group of detainees into a van, some of them reportedly chanting "Free Palestine" in a call and response with supporters standing on the side outside the police line. The US remains Israel's most important ally and biggest supplier of weapons. It has provided Israel with weapons and intelligence reports during the Gaza war and blocked United Nations resolutions calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. The British newspaper, the Financial Times, has also covered the same story and tells us more. In Chicago, where Vice President Kamala Harris officially launched her presidential campaign at the Democratic National Convention, thousands of protesters have gathered nearby for the third consecutive day, demanding an immediate ceasefire in the besieged Gaza Strip and an end to U.S. military support for Israel. Anti-Israel chants resonated through the streets surrounding the United Center in Chicago, where thousands of Democratic delegates and supporters assembled to formally nominate Kamala Harris as the party's presidential candidate. Protests continued throughout the convention, which started on Monday, 19th of August, with demands for the U.S. to cease its support for the occupying Israeli regime, which has launched a genocidal war on Gaza since October of last year. The war has resulted in the killing of over 40,000 Palestinians. Drawing parallels between this Democratic National Convention in Chicago and the previous one held in Windy City during a violent crackdown on anti-Vietnam War demonstrators decades earlier, pro-Palestine protesters shouted, "Just like in 1968, there's nothing to celebrate." Just as Hubert Humphrey lost the 1968 election to Richard Nixon, the protesters warned Kamala Harris that they would not back her unless she ends Washington's unconditional support for the regime in Tel Aviv. They waved Palestinian flags whilst marching in the streets, The protesters chanted, "DNC, your hands are red, over 40,000 dead." Protesters gathered at Union Park and began chanting before marching towards the United Center Stadium, where the Democratic National Convention was taking place. With a strong police presence in place, protesters were prevented from getting close to the venue. Whenever the protest neared the convention center, police officers blocked the road leading to the security perimeter set up around the venue. Agreeing that Wednesday's protest had been the largest of the 2024 convention,